My name is Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. Each week on this show, we will welcome a specialist who will share with us new developments in adult and pediatric medicine, as well as a range of other healthcare issues. This is an interactive program, and we will open the phones to your on-air questions and comments. I hope you'll stay with us, because together we're going to learn something about healthcare. Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Myers with Healthcare Today. Thank you for joining us on this Friday, December 11th. We're going to be talking about some very serious medical issues and questions today with Dr. Ann Dixon, who is on the line with us from Burlington. Dr. Dixon is the director of the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at the University of Vermont. And let me introduce you by telling you a little bit about her background. Dr. Dixon, as you may detect from her accent, is from England. She went to undergraduate at Cambridge University and did medical school training at Oxford in England, began with her internship in England, and then came to the United States to do both internship and residency in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins Hospital University in Baltimore. She also did her fellowship in pulmonary and critical care medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle. And currently she is a full professor, tenured professor at the University of Vermont, and is in charge of the pulmonary and critical care medicine. Dr. Dixon, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you so much. Just delighted to be on. Thank you.
Well, before we get to some of the medical issues, let me ask you this. You began your training, obviously, in two of the most prestigious institutions in England, Oxford and Cambridge, and then came to one of our most prestigious training facilities, which is Johns Hopkins. How would you characterize the difference in both medical education and in the practice of medicine, as you saw it, between England and the United States?
Well, that's a big question. I think in the UK, there's more of focus perhaps on population health and less of a reliance on technology. I think the doctors are trained in a very practical manner. In the UK, there's a lot of emphasis on listening to a patient, getting their history, getting an accurate physical exam, and there's a huge emphasis on primary care. I got to tell you that in my graduating class from Oxford, half of our class went into primary care, which is quite different than probably the graduating class of somewhere like Johns Hopkins, where probably the vast majority go into subspecialist care. Over here, I think we have wonderful access. Some of us have wonderful access to technology. We have access to world-class healthcare. And people who have insurance can certainly access that, though it can be an issue for people who don't have insurance. So this is a wonderful place to be a doctor. I think sometimes it's a little easier to be a patient in the UK.
It's interesting because several weeks ago we had on Dr. Philip Schein, who's an oncologist and who had done some early work in research and training over at Oxford, and he had almost exactly the same thoughts that you did.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. At some point we might want to cross-pollinate, once COVID is a little under better control, cross-pollinate some of the teaching between the United States and England. That would be interesting.
I think so too. Yeah.
Let me, I also usually ask our guests what drew them to their particular field of specialization or interest in medicine. What did draw you to pulmonary and critical care?
Well, if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. that's the slogan of the American Lung Association, and it is so very true. But as a doctor, I very much enjoy pulmonary and critical care. I have clinic patients, a lot of whom have asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease that I have followed for years and years and years. But you also get to practice critical care medicine, which is sort of very instantaneous and demanding subspecialty, which is also just fascinating and very challenging right now with the COVID epidemic. So it's an interesting balance. You get to do both longitudinal medicine, get to know people, but you also get to do very sort of intense critical care, and I really enjoy the balance.
And of course, at the University of Vermont, which is a teaching hospital, you are also teaching medical students and residents and fellows.
Yes, we are. We teach the medical students. We teach them sort of both the sort of basic science of respiratory physiology and how the lungs work. Then we get to work with them on the wards and introduce them to patients with both critical illness and pulmonary disease. And then we work with the internal medicine residents. And my personal thing is to try and get them all interested in pulmonary critical care medicine. And we usually get some interested. And we have
but don't steal them from primary care, please.
No, we can't steal them all from primary care. No, that's very true. We need a balance.
I want to let listeners know this is an interactive program, and as always, we welcome your comments and questions during the hour. You can reach us at 802-244-1777. That's 802-244-1777. Well, Dr. Dixon, let's talk about COVID. Obviously, it's probably first and foremost on everyone's mind now. University of Vermont Medical Center, I suppose, has been the epicenter in terms of for Vermont, in terms of the number of cases that we've seen, if not also the acuity. How many COVID patients do you currently have in your ICU right now?
Well, actually, right now, we don't have any. We had a couple earlier in the week, but right now we don't have any. So we've got our fingers and toes crossed that we can maintain that.
How do you make the decision to move someone from a regular hospital ward to your unit in the ICU?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it depends on how much oxygen a person needs. So if a person needs high levels of oxygen, we really need to have them in the intensive care unit so we can monitor them closely and deliver that level of oxygen. But it's not just dependent on their oxygen. It depends on a lot of other things. So very often people who get COVID, that they may have a very fast heart rate, a low blood pressure. There may be other things going on with their kidneys, and all of those factors will factor into our decision to transfer them to the intensive care unit.
Since the COVID epidemic started last March, can you tell us a little bit about the ways in which treatment of COVID patients has changed and what we've learned?
Sure. We now do have some treatments that the latest data do suggest work for COVID. So when we first started out, really it was just sort of supportive care, by which I mean giving people oxygen, making sure they were adequately hydrated and supporting them through their illness. Now we recognize that particularly for people with more severe disease requiring oxygen, that corticosteroids, dexamethasone, can be helpful. There's now data also suggesting that an antiviral medication, remdesivir, can be helpful for people. And more recently, there's some data that an anti-inflammatory, a JAK kinase inhibitor, infusion can also be helpful for severe disease. There's other investigational studies going on looking at convalescent plasma, which we can also consider using in certain cases, and actually have a study going on at UVMMC on that at the moment. So there are a number of medications that we can use in our armamentarium. We know now the importance of being really careful with anticoagulation. Patients with severe COVID appear to have an increased risk of clotting. And so there are a number of things that I think we do differently. We've just got a lot more experience with this disease right now.
And in terms of the non-pharmaceutical interventions, something as simple as something called proning seems to have helped. And I'll let you talk about that in a minute. But also deciding when to put someone on a ventilator. I know early on there was a great fear. We wouldn't have enough ventilator machines, and people were put on the ventilator very quickly. And now I think the thinking has changed. Can you talk about proning and how you decide when to put someone on a ventilator?
Sure. Well, we decide to put someone on a ventilator when we're having enough trouble giving them sufficient oxygen, and also when the person is just struggling to breathe, when they're getting tired. If someone has a severe pneumonia and they're working to breathe very hard all the time, it can be like trying to run a marathon, and they can get exhausted and fatigued. If they're getting tired, then they're not able to maintain their ventilation, and if we're not able to support their oxygenation, both of those factors will drive us to put people on ventilators. And when we put someone on a ventilator and we're having difficulty maintaining their oxygenation, on occasion we will put them sort of in the face down position. And actually we've discovered that even having patients who are not intubated in the face down position can actually improve their oxygenation as well.
Are there situations in which being on a ventilator actually can be harmful?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And so putting someone on a ventilator is never a decision we take lightly. If you put someone on a ventilator, they have to have a tube that goes up through their throat and into their trachea. There's always a risk that patients actually might have an increased risk of pneumonia when they're put on a ventilator, just because they can't sort of clear the natural secretions. And so there are a number of maneuvers we can take to try and minimize the risk of that happening. Also, if we put people on a ventilator, we have to be really careful. The way a ventilator works is we essentially push in oxygen and air into the lungs, and that's not the way the lungs normally work. Normally, your chest inflates, and air just goes in passively, almost sort of gets sucked in by that negative pressure. But we push in air. And if we push in air under too high a pressure, that itself can cause damage to the lungs. So we're really careful to put in a low tidal volumes so that we don't actually cause lung injury with these machines.
Is the whole presentation of COVID, the way it clinically presents, different than anything you've seen before, or is it just part of the continuum?
You know, I've been doing this sort of for a while now, and I think in retrospect, many of us think this looks like, you know, severe viral pneumonias that we have dealt with in the past. I vividly remember the H1N1 pandemic back in 2009, and we had some young people come in, you know, catastrophically ill with influenza at that time. And so I think this looks like a severe viral pneumonia.
Of course, the difference now is that rather than younger people, although we do have obviously some younger people becoming very ill and even dying, but now the majority of patients you're seeing are older and probably have some other underlying health problems, which makes it even more challenging.
Right. So that does contrast with the H1N1 pandemic back in 2009. So most of the people we are seeing who are very sick right now are older people and people with comorbidities. It's not the younger population. But actually, you know, sometimes tragically, young people that are otherwise healthy, you know, do get pretty sick with this disease.
Has our case fatality in the ICU improved? In other words, once people do reach the ICU with COVID, are we having more success in getting them alive and well, or at least safely, out of the ICU?
You know, if you look at the mortality data from New York City in the spring, it was much higher than the mortality data that we're experiencing right now. So there do appear to be improvements. And there's a lot of discussion in sort of among the medical community as to why that might be. You know, perhaps some of it is related to, you know, the new treatments we have with the antivirals and the corticosteroids. But we think much of it is also related to the fact that when the medical system gets overwhelmed, we just can't take such good care of people. And I know back in the spring there was a shortage of some of the, you know, regular medications we use to treat people, you know, the sedatives, the pain medications that we need for people on the ventilator. There was a shortage of PPE. There was a shortage of medical staff and trained nurses. And I think all of those things led to sort of the catastrophic mortality rate that they were seeing early on.
We're going to take a call in a minute, but one other question. Are you in contact with some of your colleagues in New York City and other hard-hit areas?
Yeah. Yes, very much so. And I will tell you that we are very, very blessed here in Vermont to have sort of lower rates. And my colleagues are all very, very jealous of the numbers we've got. I mean, our numbers have crept up, but I think people are just still doing a tremendous job being very careful.
Let me ask you this: in certain other conditions, we tend to transfer patients to our tertiary care centers at Dartmouth or University of Vermont Medical Center. We do have COVID patients who are very sick in some of our outlying hospitals in Vermont. Do you feel comfortable with the care they're getting there, or should physicians be thinking about transferring a patient?
Well, I think the physicians at a lot of the hospitals are sort of very, very careful, and will often call us and discuss whether or not a patient needs to be transferred. And there's a lot of factors that go into that. So certainly, if a patient is very, very sick on a ventilator, there may be more options that we've got at UVM Medical Center, and perhaps more intensivists and other subspecialists to take care of them. But sometimes patients and their families don't want to leave at their local hospital, so that will also factor into the decision. There can be a lot of factors that go into the decision to transfer to a tertiary care medical center.
Well, we've got a patient call. We've got a very patient caller here, Brenda. Thank you for being on the line. Your question.
Hi, thank you. Sure. I am aware that in the university, maybe in the engineering department, people were developing new ventilators, and I'm wondering if any of those prototypes have gotten to the ICU?
Yeah, Brenda, thank you very much for that question. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay. So Brenda, thank you so much for that question. Yes, in the Department of Engineering, back in the early spring, a number of people, including my colleague Dr. Jason Bates, were working on the Vermontilator, which is a ventilator which is particularly inexpensive and easy to produce. And they were working with the FDA on that. Since that time, the country has sort of geared up. There are more ventilators available. In fact, I heard we are going to get a shipment of more ventilators to Vermont. So production of conventional ventilators has increased. But I can tell you there was also a lot of interest in the Vermontilator from some countries that are relatively under-resourced, such as in Africa, where the entire country has very few ventilators. And so I know the engineering team are looking at the feasibility of supplying ventilators like that to some of the third world countries where there are very, very limited resources. So that's the direction that has gone in.
In times of crisis, sometimes we learn so many new techniques, new medicines, and new interventions that can be used as we move forward into the future. Now, when you talk about ventilators, we also have to have people who are trained how to run them. And one of the issues is they've called back retired physicians and others into service, but many of the, if not most of those people had never run a ventilator before, so their usefulness was somewhat limited. I know that in the hospitals, it's not only the physicians, but it's also the respiratory therapists who help run the vents, and they're really frontline people. Yeah. There has been a shortage across the country of not only nurses in many of these hard-hit hospitals, but respiratory therapists. Yeah. Have we seen that in Vermont?
Well, fortunately, I'm sort of touching wood here as we talk. We've had adequate staffing levels in terms of respiratory therapists, nurses, and physicians. But I can tell you that we all have backup plans for what we need to do in the case of surges in those numbers. But right now, we do have adequate staffing levels.
In terms of the nurses that take care of the patients, some of the nurses, certainly ICU nurses, tend to be among the most experienced in the hospital, but some of them are older. Do you pay some mind to that about which nurses are going to take care of COVID patients? If, for example, if you had a nurse that was 60 or older or had some underlying health problems, have you shifted staff around?
You know, what we've tried to do is just be really careful with PPE. And, you know, we have found with wearing adequate PPE, taking care of the patients with COVID seems to keep people protected. We have had some discussions about that, but
have you had any staff that have gotten infected, presumably in the hospital rather than out in the community?
You know, when we've looked at infections sort of within in the hospital, you would really need to sort of ask my ID colleagues. But from my understanding, is that infections in staff in the hospital have mostly been either from community transmission, so people have unfortunately sort of picked it up when they're not working. Though we have had a couple of issues where people got it when they were just simply sort of having lunch, eating together. So within the hospital, we're now much more careful to socially distance while eating.
And finally, before we go to break, and we're going to come back and talk about other pulmonary issues as well, talk to me a little bit about burnout, because we do hear reports. We're now into the eighth or ninth month of this. We're obviously in a second huge surge, and nurses, respiratory therapists, doctors, and others in the hospital have been under pressure now for an extended period of time. How do you deal with that in your staff?
I think that's a really important issue, and you know, everyone will tell you that when this first hit, there was a tremendous surge of energy. Everyone sort of pulled together, but that has left us sort of with a feeling of exhaustion, and people are really drained right now. And I will tell you that the leaders across the hospital are very aware of this, and we talk about it. We look for ways to support one another, and have tried to increase access to counseling. It's a huge problem nationwide, sort of burnout and exhaustion.
And of course, the staff isn't even able to travel or do any of the family, some of the family activities that they might have done under normal times, which only makes it worse.
Right, and you know, the normal way that we deal with stuff, you know, is you know, to be with our family or hang out with our friends, and that's not available.
A break in a minute. We're going to come back and talk with Dr. Ann Dixon in the second half of the hour. Again, our phone number is 802-244-1777. Stay with us. Dr. Lewis Myers back with Dr. Ann Dixon, director of the Division of Critical Care and Pulmonary Medicine at University of Vermont Medical Center. We have a lot more to talk about, but we're going to take a quick call from Michael in Frederick, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, the question I have, will a COPD patient have permanent lung damage of any type?
That's a good question, Dr. Dixon.
Well, Michael, that's an excellent question, and the very quick answer is we don't know. I can tell you one of my colleagues here, Dr. Dave Kaminsky, working with Dr. Katie Menson, actually have a study specifically looking at that to measure lung function on patients with COVID. We're concerned that people who have severe lung inflammation may have some scarring and some compromised lung function long term. We certainly know that in the past, people with severe pneumonia and acute respiratory distress syndrome can have long-term scarring, but we really don't know. So we need to find this out.
Well, it's ongoing. There's a lot that we're learning every day, I'm sure, particularly in centers like the University of Vermont. Let me talk to you for a moment about influenza. Normally this time of year, we would be focusing on influenza as we enter influenza season. It's a serious disease, particularly for older people or immunocompromised people. What are your thoughts this year about influenza? I had heard that, of course, influenza starts in the southern hemisphere and then works its way north, that this year's strain may be somewhat less virulent. What do you think we can expect this year from influenza?
I am hoping not much. Otherwise, I think we're going to have a real problem. I will tell you, so sort of my anecdotal evidence is that people really tried hard to get their influenza vaccine this year, I'm very grateful for that. As I look at the data from CDC, there is not much influenza activity in this country right now. I think all of the things that we are doing, the social distancing, the mask wearing that we're using to address COVID, hopefully will also protect us from influenza. So I am really hopeful that we don't get hit hard by influenza this year, because if we do, we're going to be in big trouble, because every year we get many patients, unfortunately, who do get pretty sick with influenza and end up in our ICU.
Well, I'm sure you want to help reinforce the idea that encouragement for people to get their vaccines.
Please, please do.
Help Dr. Dixon out and yourself get that vaccine. Now, I want to talk about COPD and emphysema, which you mentioned at the top of the hour you work in a clinic, and so these are serious and chronic lung diseases, usually associated but not always associated with smoking, and a big cause for hospitalizations and, unfortunately, mortality. Tell us about the prevalence of... Well, first of all, can you differentiate between COPD and emphysema?
Sure. Well, COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, includes emphysema. So we think about emphysema as destruction of the lung tissue, literally holes in the lung. And COPD includes both those holes in the lung, which is in the emphysema, and also chronic bronchitis, which is inflammation of the tubes, the lining of the lung.
In terms of the prevalence, is Vermont a high prevalent state for COPD? I know that we have a higher than average rate of smoking compared to many states in the country.
Our prevalence of COPD is about the same as the rest of the country, which is much more common than we would like. So COPD is a very common comorbidity.
What are some of the treatments, both the old tried and true treatments and some of the new treatments that you can offer people with COPD?
Well, I think the most important treatment is quitting smoking. And some people have just... are just so frustrated when they get COPD that it's very hard for them to think, is it worth quitting smoking? But we know that people who quit smoking with COPD do much better than people who don't quit smoking. And there are good treatments out there to help people with smoking cessation. So I would urge people who are still smoking to think about quitting and go talk to the doctor about some of the options and different medications that might be out there. That is by far and away the most important intervention.
Well, I would agree. And it's interesting because many times I've seen people who actually have a heart attack quit smoking the day of their heart attack and they never smoke again. But COPD is more of a chronic condition, and there's no particular cut point where they can say, I'm going to quit this today because... You know.
Right, that the sort of only comparable thing that we see occasionally is people who end up in our ICU on a ventilator, and that that might be sort of the version of a heart attack, which makes them quit smoking. And then after smoking cessation, vaccination is really important. So getting vaccinated against influenza and pneumococcal pneumonia, that is critically important for people with COPD. And we know that improves outcomes. And then after that, we think about bronchodilator medication to just open up those airways a little bit. And for people with just mild COPD, they can get by with just using those as and when they need it, when they're short of breath. But with people with more severe disease, we will put them on scheduled bronchodilator medication, and that really does help. And then some patients require bronchodilator medication combination with inhaled corticosteroids. Some patients may require oxygen, and we know if your oxygen level is low and we put you on oxygen, you live longer. So that is something else that we think about. And then for some patients, pulmonary rehabilitation and exercise programs specifically for people with COPD can be incredibly helpful.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, you mentioned oxygen, the studies about oxygen and how it helps, and what are the criteria for starting someone on home oxygen?
Sure. No, that's an excellent question. Well, we have known since the 70s, actually, that if your oxygen level is low, persistently low, and you use oxygen, that improves survival in people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And it likely does that because low oxygen level is a strain on the heart. So if your oxygen level is persistently low, people develop heart failure. So the oxygen really is designed to prevent heart failure. More recently, studies have been done looking at people whose oxygen level is just sort of a little bit lower than normal when they're walking around. Those people can probably get by without starting on oxygen immediately. But if your oxygen level is low, even when you're sitting not doing anything, and by low I mean less than 88% on room air, that's really when oxygen will be beneficial. If we put you on oxygen, you will live longer.
You mentioned pulmonary rehab, and that's, I think, in some ways an underused modality. When should primary care physicians and other providers think about referring their patients for pulmonary rehab?
Well, think about it. If your patient is having difficulty walking around, so the criteria based on FEV1, but I would sort of get in your head if you've got a patient who you think has moderate to severe COPD and is having difficulty getting around, I refer them to pulmonary rehab. I will tell you right now, this is quite difficult for us because we can't do the in-person classes. But we do have some remote options that we're trying to work on. And many people with severe COPD who can't exercise look at me as though I'm crazy when I suggest exercising. But it actually is amazing to do this structured pulmonary rehabilitation program. We really find people do get tremendous benefit, and people who thought they would never be able to exercise. So I do encourage people to consider doing that or discussing that with their physician.
Yeah, I think that cardiac rehab is certainly, people are more aware of that, but I'm glad that you have brought up pulmonary rehab. How dangerous is secondhand smoke?
Secondhand smoke, we know, does cause decrements in lung function, and is a risk factor for the development of COPD. That's certainly been studied in a number of settings. So secondhand smoke, even for people without lung problems, can cause lung problems. And then for secondhand smoke can be very dangerous for our children. So parents who smoke are increasing the risk that children will develop asthma and have long-term health problems. If you live with someone who has lung problems and you smoke, that's very problematic as well.
Let me ask you now about cystic fibrosis, which is It's rare, but it's actually, I believe, the most commonly inherited genetic
disorder.
At the University of Vermont, I believe you have a center to treat cystic fibrosis.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about the disease and about your center?
Sure. Cystic fibrosis is the most common genetic disorder causing lung disease. And it causes bronchiectasis, this sort of dilation and inflammation of the bronchial tubes. And it can also be associated with GI problems, and can present actually in young infants with bowel obstruction. And it's caused by a defect in the airway epithelium, the lining of the airway, one of the chloride channels, which transports actually chloride in and out of the airway. And it means that the mucus becomes sort of much, much thicker and much more difficult for the airway to clear the mucus. And so that mucus gets chronically infected, and people with cystic fibrosis get recurrent lung infections, which causes severe damage to their lungs. And when I was in medical school, the average life expectancy of children with cystic fibrosis was sort of late teens, early 20s at best. And this has dramatically changed over the last few years. And the thing that has really sort of transformed the treatment of cystic fibrosis, and really in my time here at UVM, is there are a number of cystic fibrosis modulated drugs which actually work on this chloride channel to make the chloride channel work. This is really seems to be having a dramatic effect. I think it's too early to know how much it's going to increase life expectancy, but I will tell you, when I first started here at UVM Medical Center, we regularly had 6 to 8 adults with cystic fibrosis being hospitalized, being treated for lung infections every day. And I think, very often now we have no adults hospitalized at all with cystic fibrosis.
How many patients are in your clinic? How many patients in cystic fibrosis do you follow?
We have about 80 adults with cystic fibrosis that we follow. And I think there are about, which is slightly larger than the pediatric clinic now, and that's been the other change, is the adult clinic is now larger than the pediatric clinic as the adults are living longer.
You mentioned the life expectancy used to be in the 20s. What about now?
Yeah, as I was saying that, I was thinking, I bet you he's going to follow up and ask me that question. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I think it's late 30s and maybe even 40s. It's dramatically different.
Is there a role for gene therapy and or lung transplantation?
Yeah, well, gene therapy has sort of been explored not successful to date. That's not to say it never will be, but that has not been successful to date. Lung transplant is used for patients with cystic fibrosis who have end-stage lung disease, and so our goal is to try and stop them getting there. But certainly, yes, we have a number of folks we follow who've had cystic fibrosis and now have had lung transplants.
Is there screening for cystic fibrosis in utero?
Yes, there's in utero screening. People like carriers, they can be screened, and there is also screening, newborn screening that's also done.
What age does cystic fibrosis clinically present generally?
Yeah, well, the classic form of cystic fibrosis. So cystic fibrosis can be caused by a number of different mutations, sort of genetic abnormalities, and the most common ones present sort of an infant or early childhood. But there are some rarer forms of the disease which can actually manifest in sort of mid to late adulthood, actually. We have... We had one woman who was diagnosed after actually both of her daughters were diagnosed.
So there's a range of severity.
There's a range of severity, which likely depends on the particular genetic variant that people have.
Well, we have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about asthma, perhaps as common or more common even than COPD, and obviously both pediatric and adults can get asthma, whereas COPD is more likely to present in adulthood. Tell us about the treatments in asthma. Where are we, and what have we learned?
Sure. Well, there have actually been new treatment guidelines that were released last week by NIH for the treatment of asthma. And a lot of discussion about how we're going to implement those. So the things that have changed in terms of treatment for asthma is thinking about using sort of an anti-inflammatory inhaled corticosteroids at the same time as we're using rescue therapy. So traditionally, the way we've treated asthma is we've given people a rescue, an albuterol or a Ventolin inhaler, as our first-line therapy and told them to use that sort of as and when they need it for rescue therapy. But the thing that is changing with the new guidelines is actually to think about using a combination of inhaled corticosteroid with a beta agonist for rescue therapy. And so that is going to be something that we're thinking about sort of how to implement are going to be doing over the next couple of years, I expect. The other new thing we've got for asthma over the last few years is there are a number of what we call biologics for severe asthma. So this is antibody-based therapy that works either on allergic asthma or people with what we call severe eosinophilic asthma. And that really has transformed the treatment of some forms of asthma. So those, I think, are the sort of big things on the horizon.
Is there an environmental component to asthma?
For some, yes, and for some it can be just a totally sort of intrinsic thing. So in terms of environmental exposures that are associated with asthma, some people have sort of allergic triggers to their asthma. We recognize that people get asthma around the cats or the dogs. Children are more likely to develop asthma if their parents have smoked. People who live sort of in a polluted environment are more likely to develop their asthma. And one which I do sort of a lot of work on is looking at how obesity increases the risk of developing asthma.
Are African-American children more prone to asthma, or is it more related to their environment in which they're living?
Really, really good question, and sort of very, very difficult to answer. So this may be another manifestation of sort of social disparities as much as sort of genetic differences. Many African American children are growing up sort of in inner cities, living in sort of poor housing, without limited access to health care and a lot of exposure to air pollution, and perhaps that is driving their asthma. I think most of us think it's a combination of genetic and environmental factors, but the environmental factors are certainly a huge component.
So you mentioned a moment ago about new combinations of medicines we're using for asthma, and I was thinking that with COVID, we're learning warp speed, and really in real time, from one week to the next, about how to treat this disease. Asthma is a very common condition, which we're learning over the years. How does a field change in something like asthma? How does thinking in a medical field change?
Well, I think it's changed a lot. And
what leads to the change, though, from your experience over the years?
Well, it's a combination of studies, sort of epidemiologic studies in large populations, and understanding what are the risk factors for developing asthma, and very, very careful scientific studies trying to understand some of the molecular pathways that are contributing to these sort of entities that, we recognize in, the clinic. And it's the combination of understanding exactly sort of what is going on with the patient at the clinical level, with really good studies at the bench at the scientific level. And I think that's what's making the difference in asthma, and I think that's what's making the difference in things like cystic fibrosis.
And then, of course, it filters down to your medical students that you're teaching, which is part of your other job description.
And we hope.
Hats that you wear. If in the last couple of minutes we have, if you're standing in front of your medical school class today, these young medical students are, or sometimes older medical students coming into the field, entering the field of medicine, what do you tell them?
Listen to your patients and learn over your entire lifetime. Things change. The medicine that I learned when I was in medical school, things are very, very different now. So you need to be a student your entire life and listen to your patients because they know their body pretty well.
And listen to their families, and I imagine as well, since you, in an intensive care unit especially, you
the patients cannot always talk to us.
No, and a high percentage of patients never survive the ICU, even despite best efforts. So there's a lot of grief.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that yourself?
It can be incredibly hard, and I think those of us who work in the ICU, sort of talking it through with our colleagues and debriefing with one another after a stressful event is tremendously important. And I think that's one of the problems that the community is facing now, so with COVID, is it's not so easy to debrief with our colleagues. We're supposed to maintain social distance. We're not supposed to socialize with one another. So I think that's another reason that COVID is so hard for the medical community to cope with.
Well, Dr. Ann Dixon, you, first of all, I want to thank you for being here in the hour, but more broadly, I want to thank you for being on the front lines, for doing all that you do in this difficult time in Vermont. And we hope you'll come back again at a future time. But thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you and answering those questions. Thank you.
And I hope you'll be with us next week. We're going to turn to something perhaps a little less severe, but still very prevalent, and that is the care of feet and ankles. We're going to be with podiatrist Dr. Mary Hsu. So if you have had any problems with your feet or ankles or any questions, you'll want to tune in, I hope, next week. We'll see you then. In the meantime, be kind to yourselves. Take good care.
Music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.